Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Undiscovered. So heads up, there is no salty language in this episode, but there's some stuff that we describe that is graphic and upsetting. So this one's not for kids.
Here? Where? I don't know. Do you need me closer?
Yeah, no, you're good.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so
Annie, I started my interview with Sean Johnson the way that we usually do. You know, you check your levels by asking them what they had for breakfast.
Always.
Oatmeal and cottage cheese. I don't know why I had to think about that. No, I actually eat the same five things every day, so that's why it was weird. Yeah, like a very type A meal prepper.
Sean is actually a type A everything. We met up at Harvard, where he goes to medical school.
Of course.
Of course. On top of being a medical student, he started an after-school science education program. He does peer mentoring. He also volunteers with local cancer researchers.
Like on the side?
Like on the side, which I tell him, this sounds like a lot to me. And he's like, no, no, no. Don't be ridiculous.
My dad is a truck driver, has been driving trucks since I was born, is in his 60s, is driving up and on the West Coast. Like, that's hard. My mom gets up at the like crack of dawn, like takes public transit into work, gets back home at like 7 or 8, and does it every single day. Like, that stuff is hard. Sitting in like a classroom and reading and then going to some meetings and sending emails, that's easy.
All right, well, now I feel like a big baby, which I am. It's fine. It's fine. You can shame me. Sean wasn't one of these kids who grew up wanting to be a doctor. But when he was in college, his sister Ashley died of cancer. And after that, he decided, I want to do something about this. I want to do something about cancer. So after college, he lands a job as a research technician at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And then one day while he's there, he finds out about a drug that could have saved his sister's life.
It was actually an interesting story. So I was shadowing with a physician, spending the day with him.
This doctor was involved in a clinical trial with a cancer drug called brentuximab vedotin. Sean had never heard of it, so later he looks it up.
And I was reading about it, and I come across this article saying that it was approved in Hodgkin's like X number of years ago. And that floored me because I had never heard of this before.
Hodgkin's lymphoma, that's actually what Sean's sister had. And so he looks at the dates, and he figures out that when Ashley was sick, this drug was going through clinical trials. It had actually reached phase 3 clinical trials. You only do phase 3 once a drug shows promise. And in this clinical trial, the results were really good. For 86% of patients, the tumor actually shrank, but
I never heard about it. She never heard about it. Like, nobody ever approached us about being in a study. And that, I remember, was really upsetting. Like, there was a time there was a long time actually where I had the article of the drug being approved in Hodgkin's like on my desk.
To be clear, Sean didn't think that anyone was actually trying to keep his sister out of this. Like, he didn't think that they were deliberately hiding this trial from her. But he did see this as part of a bigger problem. Because by the time that he found out about this drug, he'd already noticed something about oncology research.
A lot of the people that I was seeing who were coming in for clinical research didn't look like people like me.
Sean's dad is Black, his mom is white, and he identifies as Black.
Didn't look like people like from the community, didn't look like people who I was spending time with outside my work.
So this is actually part of a broader pattern. In cancer research in this country, the most promising clinical trials are done mostly on white people, which means people of color, and Black people in particular, are often not included in research that might save their lives. And Sean, he wants to change that.
I'm Annie.
And I'm Ella. And in today's episode, Sean confronts the medical abuses that have led generations of African Americans to distrust medical researchers. And then he convinces a team of Boston scientists to let him try something pretty counterintuitive to try to win that trust back.
That's coming up on Undiscovered.
The patients that Sean saw coming in for these clinical trials, they weren't just white. They also seemed pretty affluent to Sean, which kind of made sense. He figured if you're poor, if you're working long hours, you are not necessarily going to have the time to go looking for the best and most promising clinical trials for your condition. And they might not be finding you either. But as for people of color, Sean thought this was more than a lack of access. He'd actually grown up hearing people say that doctors and medical researchers should not be trusted.
I remember my uncle, when I was younger, told me this really like weird story about how he thought that the city was like putting male birth control into fast food restaurants. He wasn't like a crazy guy. It's not like he thought there were like UFOs and like aliens and all kinds of other stuff. He just believed that like the medical system was doing these things.
And the more that he looked around, the more that he started noticing other people saying stuff like this.
First barber I had in Boston, he asked me where I worked. And then as soon as we started talking, he's like, you know, they have a cure for AIDS at Dana-Farber, right?
Dana-Farber, that's where Sean worked. So this distrust, this fear that you're being lied to or experimented on, a lot of people will try to explain that with Tuskegee. Tuskegee was this 40-year-long experiment, actually ran into the 70s, where the U.S. government denied black men treatment for syphilis. Actually, didn't just deny them treatment, they gave them fake treatment, and they went around preventing local doctors from treating them, just so that they could see what this disease did to them. But to Sean, it seemed obvious that this was about way more than Tuskegee.
Everybody goes, oh, well, Tuskegee happened, and now every black person in America knows about Tuskegee. But that's kind of ridiculous, right? Like, a lot of people you'll talk to have no idea what that is. But a lot of people will stay, like, my like auntie or my grandma or, like, me, myself. Like, I don't want to go to these academic hospitals because I'll be experimented on. I might get a placebo.
So Sean decided he wanted to read more about this history, and he started with a book called Medical Apartheid.
So Medical Apartheid is a 400-page survey of the history of experimentation on black people in the United States. It is a heavy read. And it starts with the story of J. Marion Sims. J. Marion Sims is sometimes called the father of modern gynecology. Until a few months ago, there was actually a statue of him in New York City in Central Park.
I would eat my lunch under that statue when I was doing research on the book.
That's Harriet Washington. She wrote Medical Apartheid.
And I initially had warm feelings toward Dr. Sims because initially I believed what I had read, that he was a medical hero.
A 19th century doctor from South Carolina. Sims was famous for inventing the duckbill speculum, which is actually the precursor of the speculum gynecologists use today. But maybe his most famous accomplishment was for his cure for vesicovaginal fistulas. Vesicovaginal fistulas are something that can happen after very, very prolonged labor, where the bladder and the vagina fuse together. This condition is exactly as terrible as it sounds.
So he tried to cure it, and here's how he tried to do it. He acquired black women.
Black women who had been enslaved and had these fistulas.
And then he proceeded to repeatedly experiment on closing their vesicovaginal fistula. Now, what this means is very difficult to hear about or to read about.
Sims kept 12 women in what he called his little hospital, which he built in the corner of his yard. And for 5 years, between 1845 and 1849, he did experimental surgeries on these women, over and over, sometimes in front of an audience of surgeons. Sometimes he would have two men holding them down. It took 30 surgeries to cure one of these women, a woman named Anarka. And this part is key. Surgeons were just starting to use anesthetic at the time, and Sims later said that he thought these operations weren't painful enough to, quote, justify the trouble and risk. So all of those operations, done without anesthesia.
Not everything in this book was done over 100 years ago either. Sean read about experiments on prisoners, experiments done on children, like one study where scientists injected black and Hispanic boys as young as 6 with a drug to curb their so-called risk for aggression. And that was in the 90s.
So there's this like long history where really if you were black and somebody said, do you want to be in a clinical trial, you should have run, right? Like, that's the hard part, is that like more than likely it was a bad idea too.
So it took Sean a while to get through this book. And when he was done, he was angry.
I felt like, for me, a piece of my history like hadn't been given to me. Like, why did I have to wait until I was 25 to read this book to learn about people who are my family, like generations ago, like dealt with?
Now that Sean knew this history, the idea that someone would think their city was drugging them or that scientists might have a secret cure for AIDS they weren't telling people about, it made more sense. That mistrust came from somewhere.
So in some ways, of course, medicine has changed. There are rules and safeguards in place that were not there before. But safeguards aren't guarantees. And let me say super clearly, there is a whole aspect to this story that is not behind us, that isn't history. Studies show people of color are still treated worse by our medical system. A 2003 National Academies report found people of color were less likely than white people to be given the right medications for their heart disease, to get bypass surgery or transplants or dialysis. Other studies have found doctors underrate the pain of their Black patients and actually prescribe them less pain medication. So you add that all up, lack of trust, justified lack of trust, plus probably an even bigger factor, which is lack of access. And the upshot is the most promising clinical trials don't include many Black people in them.
Right. That's not good. It's not good to be excluded from a clinical trial that might save your life. It's not good for medicine either, right? We want treatments that work for as many patients as possible, patients with different genes and environments, not just the subset of people that we happen to study. So a couple of years ago, Sean decided that he wanted to do something about this. Like, he wanted to get more Black patients involved in medical research. And then he found out about a project directed by Corey Painter, scientist and wild woman.
Here are the Vavas. These are our guinea hens. This is Honey.
Hi, Honey.
She is a brat and a bully. Do not let her fool you.
I went to meet Corey at her home. It's about an hour outside of Boston. She has guinea hens, chickens, bees, a dog, a cat, a snake, a rabbit, and goats.
Come on, Daddy.
When I ask Corey what she had for breakfast, she tells me she foraged for berries.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Anyway, Corey, besides being a wild woman, she's also a biochemist, and she directs the Metastatic Breast Cancer Project, MBC Project for short, which is at MIT and Harvard's Broad Institute. So it turns out, and I didn't know this before, but there are people's tumor samples just sitting in storage in labs and hospitals across the country.
Just sitting there.
Yeah. The idea is they might be needed for later testing, but a lot of the time, like,
just sitting there.
Nothing's being done with them. So the MBC Project figures, like, what if we could actually make use of those? What if we could look at cancer DNA from these tumor samples, compare that to DNA from non-cancer cells from the same patients, and then we can see how, for example, how cancer mutates, maybe find genes that predispose people to certain cancers. All of this, of course, depends on getting consent from the patients. So if someone's interested,
we send them a consent form. If they provide consent, then we send them a saliva kit.
Basically a tube that they have to fill up with spit and mail back. That saliva is to give you those non-cancer cells. And then the researchers ask for your medical records and permission to get that slice of the tumor that's being kept in storage.
We send the tissue plus their saliva kit off for sequencing at the genomics platform at the Broad Institute.
They officially launched the project in October of 2015, spread the word through social media, which actually worked really well for them. Within a year, they had almost 3,000 patients sign
up. That's a lot.
Yeah, and they were thrilled about it. But of those patients, only about 2% identified as Black or African American.
Which is a problem if you're doing a breast cancer study. Because African American women are more likely to die of breast cancer than white women. And it's thought a lot of that is because of this lack of access to medical care that we've been talking about. But that doesn't explain why Black women are more likely to develop aggressive breast cancers, like triple negative breast cancer. That's the hardest to treat. And no one really knows why that difference exists. And we're not going to if there are no African Americans in these studies.
Right. So the MBC project knew that they needed way more than 2%. But Corey didn't necessarily feel like she was the best person to fix this problem. Corey has actually been a cancer patient herself, so she could connect with other cancer patients on that level, but at the same time.
I am a middle-aged white woman. I have no context to understand, like, a lifetime of what people of color experience.
And then one day, a young cancer researcher shows up and says, hey, that's something I can help with. It is Sean Johnson.
Aha.
Yeah. So Sean had heard about the MBC project back when he was at Dana-Farber, and it just seemed like a natural fit. And so he contacts the MBC team and says, hey, let's get more Black people in your study. Although, qualifier.
I'm Black, but I'm not a woman. I'm not a Black woman, and I'm not a Black woman with breast cancer.
Note, men can get breast cancer too. though not nearly as often?
And so the most obvious thing was, if we want to reach more Black women with breast cancer, we should ask Black women with breast cancer, like, what they think we should do.
The NBC team, of course, was on board. This made a lot of sense. Except Sean had one more idea. He was like, let me talk to these women that we'd like to bring on board for our medical research. And then let me tell them about how medical research has abused African Americans for literally centuries. Because Sean had this question.
If patients in marginalized communities have fears about the medical system, how do you address that? Like, do you talk about it at all? Do you not bring it up? And if people ask, just like tell them like how things are safe? Or, and this was my interest, like, what if you just give people all this history?
Would it make Black patients more interested in collaborating with them or less? So the NBC team, one of its guiding principles is transparency. But this idea that Sean had, it went way beyond transparency. Sean's approach was more like radical honesty. You know, don't just acknowledge the history of exploitation if people bring it up. Actively teach it. Talk about it, you know? If you do that, Sean wanted to know,
what happens? Like, what happens if you sit and you give the whole history of this?
Coming up, what happens? Sean puts radical honesty to the test.
One of the first people that the NBC project would talk to was Bridget Hempstead. Bridget is no newbie to medical trials. She remembers at the first one she participated in, they gave her shots, which hurt a lot.
Let me tell you how they hurt. So it feels like if you took the lips of your vagina and put them over your head.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite graphic. Thank you.
I can't describe to you how painful they were.
So these shots were in her arm, just side note.
Okay.
In case you were wondering. Anyway, this trial where they inflicted on Bridget worse pain than I am willing to imagine.
Uh-huh.
Bridget actually, she had to fight to get into this. Her original doctor hadn't been supportive of her signing up, so she got rid of that doctor, got a new one. And at this point, she'd beaten back her metastatic breast cancer. This was actually a trial for a vaccine that might prevent that cancer from coming back. Basically, a series of shots that might help the immune system fight off that cancer.
And I'm telling you, I probably should have been drunk when they did it, but I was not.
Bridget was actually first diagnosed with breast cancer back in the 90s. And she remembers back then she didn't see a lot of Black women in breast cancer awareness campaigns. So she had the impression that breast cancer was mainly a white woman's problem. And it seemed like her doctor did too. Her doctor refused to give Bridget a mammogram when she asked for one. She gives her a few reasons, like Bridget's age. She was only 34 at the time, which is
young.
Yeah, it's young. But also, she said this.
She told me that I was African American and I didn't need to worry about it and come back in 10 years.
Yeah, so like when people talk about mistrust of doctors, like this is the kind of stuff
this is exactly,
they're talking about.
Yeah, so Bridget actually had to insist. She got that mammogram and of course it turned out that she did have breast cancer. She was diagnosed actually on her 35th birthday. And this moment, it actually turned Bridget into an activist. Today, she runs a national African-American breast cancer network called the Sierra Sisters. And one of the things that she wants to see more of is more African-American patients being studied in medical research. So when one day Corey reaches out to Bridget and asks her if she might help NBC figure out how to be more inclusive, Bridget is in. So in the fall of 2016, Bridget and five other women who do this kind of advocacy around breast cancer, they travel to Boston to meet the NBC team.
Yeah, there's a video of this meeting. You can see everybody gathered around this conference table. And at the front of the room is this young Black med school student.
Do you need a stand?
Sean Johnson.
Okay, thank God. Not sleep much last night.
He starts off light.
And I still remember the first time that I left home to come here in 2010, I called my dad up, and this is a real conversation. I go, oh, yeah. I was like, I got into some internship at Harvard Medical School. And he goes, there's Black people there? I was like, well, there must be one now. And so when he asked me, he goes, are you going to be, like, experimenting on people? I was like, no, Dad, like, that's not what I'm doing.
And Sean tells them, like, that distrust, it's not just paranoia. It is not new. It goes way back. And that's when he starts launching into this history. Because remember, this is like what this talk is about for Sean. He wants to know, would telling people about this history help dissolve some of that distrust? Like, would it encourage people to be part of research, to collaborate with researchers? So he tells them about J. Marion Sims, the gynecologist who practiced surgeries on enslaved women. He tells them about medical schools that stole black bodies out of cemeteries. And of course, he tells them about Tuskegee. It is an intense 30 minutes.
So that's my hopefully not too gloomy presentation on the history of medical mistrust.
While Sean's talking, it's hard to tell what Bridget and the other women around this table might be thinking. They're mostly quiet. They're jotting down notes on legal pads. But as soon as he stops, it becomes clear this hit home.
It makes you want to cry that that a group of people have been so mistreated.
And that was Bridget.
It was horrible then, and it's horrible now just because of the way that some of the physicians believe that we're so different, that we're still dehumanized as individuals.
Oh, his presentation was so good. It was incredible.
So Bridget had actually heard a lot of what Sean talked about that day before, but having it all laid out like that, that was powerful. And it clearly landed for the other women that day, too.
This is priceless. Like,
that was one of the women off mic. She says this should be taught to every medical student. And then another woman, LaTanya Wilson, she goes even bigger.
You know, I was sitting here thinking, and it might sound a little crazy, but he needs to actually hit every African-American or just every television station. I mean, I was just thinking that BT, just everything, CNN. I'm serious because, like how you stated, I've heard about the Tuskegee, but everything else, didn't hear it.
So Sean's gamble was that if you talk to people about this history, they might be even more excited to work with you, right? To make the future of medicine different. But if that hadn't been the outcome, if people heard his presentation and thought, like, no, thank you, I want nothing to do with medical research, Sean would have been fine with that too.
People just have a right to their history. Regardless of what people's response is, I actually don't think that matters. Like, I think patients of color particularly should know this is what happened. And I think maybe this could be like a contentious viewpoint, but if that makes more people not participate, that's their choice.
But that's clearly not what happened here.
For me, it validated, yes, you acknowledge what happened, but it gives you the empowerment to where are we going?
Which, of course, is what this meeting was all about. Where is the MBC project going? What should they do differently? And actually, the women around this table definitely had some ideas about that. Like the MBC project's flyer. So LaTanya starts telling them about this thing that happened the other day to her. She was at a hospital. She starts talking to another woman, finds out that this woman has stage 4 breast cancer.
And I said, you're stage 4? I said, you participate in this project right here. And
so LaTanya pulls out the project's flyer, hands it to this woman. And this woman looks at it and she says,
a whole bunch of white people on here. And I started laughing.
For Corey, who directs the project, this was kind of a revelation. Like the main image on this flyer, it's a photograph of a woman standing on a hilltop. She has a ponytail. The sun is behind her, so she's a silhouette. She's fully in shadow, and you can't see her skin color. But the women around this table are like, yeah, but she's still white.
And we're like, oh, wait, wait, it's a silhouette, like on purpose. We thought we were doing good.
The reason why you would say yes, she's white, because a lot of black people are not
hiking.
They're not hiking.
The MBC project took those recommendations. The shoelaces are now gone, so it looks a bit less like a hiking shoe. The hair is short and curly.
You know, these are like small things, obviously, but they matter. If you don't see yourself in a campaign, you might not think that its message is for you. So another piece of feedback that MBC got was, go to the people you're trying to reach, like visit black communities, maybe hit up churches. So that's what they're trying to do. Like just one example, Sean, got a group going at Howard University. It's this group of volunteers, and they try to recruit people around D.C., get them involved in the study. Their first outing was a couple of weeks ago to a church.
Hello, how are you today?
It's a super busy Sunday. People are leaving services, milling around. A few older women come by the table, and they pick up the brochures they have there, which feature the new image.
The new image, of course, yes.
Yes. They seem to really appreciate what the students are doing.
Well, God bless your ministry. Thank you. I hope and pray y'all get this thing.
Thank you so much.
So recruitment is underway. As for how the project's working out?
The project is going really well. So we have had so many people enroll, over 4,700 people.
And actually, since we talked to Corey, that number has gone up. It's over 5,000 now. And since Sean joined this project, they've more than doubled the number of people in the study who identify as Black or African-American. They now have actually the most African-American people with metastatic breast cancer who have ever been included in a study. But you look at the raw numbers, that's just 142 people out of 5,000, less than 3%.
So we have a lot of work to do.
So ideally, they'll get somewhere that's closer to actual patient demographics. And if they get a more diverse gene pool, they stand a better chance of discovering new cancer genes. They might even figure out if there are some genes that play a part in why African Americans do get those more aggressive breast cancer types. But researchers who do this kind of work have to be so careful. Because if there's one thing we've learned, it's that we are so quick to harp on differences, especially racial differences, even when those differences do not exist. So I asked Sean about this. How do you do this work? How do you get more diverse patients in medical research without inadvertently othering them?
So I think the biggest way you can say that you do this is you have to have people who represent the groups that you're talking about be really in charge of leading it, or at least be like advising on it. Because then you don't run into like just some of the dumb stuff. Like, I hope that more of this work happens. I hope that there's more of a focus on having diverse representation in clinical trials and clinical research. Are people going to mess up? Absolutely. That's just like a given.
This work that Sean wants to see happening, this reckoning with medicine's past and present, it's happening more and more. And not just around conference tables at fancy research institutes. Like a few months ago, New York City finally took down that statue of Marion Sims, the gynecologist, that had stood in Central Park for 84 years. It took more than a decade of work by local activists to make this happen. They'd protested and petitioned until finally the city relented. So in April, Parks Department workers strapped Sims into a bright blue harness and then carefully lifted him off of his pedestal. Nearby, people chanted.
So now there's just the granite pedestal. The city has said it's going to leave it there. They've talked about adding plaques with some extra historical context about what Sims did and who he did it to, including the only three names that we know for the women he experimented on: Anarka, Betsy, and Lucy. They've also talked about commissioning a new artwork, something that honors women of color in science. But for now, the granite pedestal stands bare. The statue is gone, hopefully making way for something better to take its place. Undiscovered is reported and produced by me, Ella Fetter.
And me, Annie Minoff. We had production help this week from Alexa Lim, story consulting from Linda Villarosa, and fact-checking help from Robin Palmer.
Our senior editor is Christopher Intagliata. Our composer is Daniel Peterschmidt. And our production intern is Caitlin Swaljay. I Am Robot and Proud wrote our theme. Thank you also to Deirdre Cooper Owens, who talked to us about James Marion Sims. If you want to learn more about Sims and the complicated history of gynecology, we recommend reading her book, Medical Bondage.
And that brings us to the end of Undiscovered Season 2. Thank you so much for listening these past 10 weeks. We will really try not to leave you hanging quite so long between seasons this time. But in the meantime, please help us make this a better show. We've got a survey up at undiscoveredpodcast.org/survey. Or if you just want to sign up for our newsletter and be the first to know about new episodes, you can do that at that same link, undiscoveredpodcast.org/survey.
Finally, to learn more about this episode, visit our website, undiscoveredpodcast.org. And we'll see you soon.